Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Good to have you along here as we begin to wind down the month of January this new year of 2017. I'm Neil Stavem, along with Ted Ross and Chris Rogers here on Connecting Faith. It was in 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Paul is reporting on some of the challenges that he and his team faced in their journeys, and he made this statement: "We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired of life itself." You know, in our culture and around the world, there are some that reach that point of despairing of life itself, and they choose to take their own life. And on Connecting Faith today, we'll address the topic of suicide, how to prevent it, how to help those families and communities affected by it. Of course, Ted, the top story in the news today and this weekend has been the president's decision to halt immigration into the U.S. from some Muslim countries.
Yeah, activities at airports around the country, a lot of protesting.
Well, I want to let you know that tomorrow, Matthew Sorens from World Relief, who works with refugees and immigration, leads that team, will be with us for the hour to review immigration, refugees, and the church. So I want to encourage you to tune in for that. In the meantime, though, today we're going to learn from a professor and a psychologist working in the mental health field and author a new resource on preventing suicide. And in preparation for today's program, I came across this quote from Henry Nouwen. He said, "When we honestly ask ourselves which person in our lives means the most to us, we often find that it is those who, instead of giving advice, solutions, or cures, have chosen rather to share our pain and touch our wounds with a warm and tender hand. The friend who can be silent with us in a moment of despair or confusion, who can stay with us in an hour of grief and bereavement, who can tolerate not knowing, not curing, not healing, and face with us the reality of our powerlessness, that is a friend who cares."
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about how we can encourage those who have gone through loss, in particular this painful loss, a family member choosing suicide. We'll discuss it today. I do want to just mention, too, that, Ted, we've just, from time to time, we have the opportunity to give away a study Bible in this month, the month of February, for the next 4 weeks. Looking forward to giving away the Beyond Suffering Study Bible.
Wonderful work put together by Johnny Erickson Tada, who, of course, knows suffering firsthand and has been through a lot time and again, but she holds on firmly to her faith and has some great anecdotes in this work. So sign up for that if you'd like to enter the drawing.
You can find it at myfaithradio.com, the Beyond Suffering Study Bible, or Bible study giveaway this month. Let me introduce my guest today, and we'll get started with the program. Karen Mason is an associate professor of counseling and psychology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, and she's a psychologist working in the mental health field. She's previously managed the Office of Suicide Prevention for the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. She's a member of the American Psychological Association, and she's author of several books, including When the Pieces Don't Fit, Making Sense of Life's Puzzles, and the latest is Preventing Suicide, a Handbook for Pastors, Chaplains, and Pastoral Counselors. And we're going to put ourselves in the pastoral and the counselor role today and draw some great insights from Karen Mason, who's with us on Connecting Faith. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Neil.
Looking forward to this conversation, rather sobering one, and maybe we'll just begin right in. I think we all probably know of someone in our community or maybe in our family that is dealing with the loss of a death by suicide, but tell us kind of a bit about the statistics of how prevalent is this and is it growing?
Well, Neil, unfortunately it is, and that is a huge tragedy in our society. One thing some people may not know is that suicide is the 10th leading cause of death. A lot of people think, hey, more Americans die by maybe homicide, but that's the 16th leading cause of death. So, and unfortunately, these numbers do seem to be growing.
Is it, and there's a difference, obviously, between actual and attempted, too, isn't there?
Correct. Yeah. So, you know, studies have found that for every 14 people who die each year, there are probably about 500 people who attempt suicide, and then another 3,000 who are thinking about suicide. So at any point or for any year in the United States, about 8 million Americans think about suicide. So, yeah, definitely suicide death is such a tragedy, but, you know, there are others who are touched by it.
Is this a something where more men and women, or is it a younger, older? Paint a little profile if there is, a center, I guess, of the curve here.
Yes, right. Well, you know, interestingly, or maybe unexpectedly, actually, more men die by suicide, but more women tend to attempt suicide. So I think one way that's helpful to think about it is that different ages and different genders are touched by the issue of suicide a little bit differently. So, for instance, suicide is the 10th leading cause of death, I was saying, across all age ranges. But in the younger age ranges, like 10 to 14 years old, it's the third leading cause of death. And in the 15 to 34-year-olds, it's the second leading cause of death. So certainly it happens. Probably the numbers are greater in middle ages, but it very definitely happens in those younger ages as well. And, you know, as I was saying, you know, with actual suicide deaths also come suicide attempts, and those do seem to be a little more prevalent among women as opposed to deaths a little bit more among men. So it just seems like across the ages and genders, everyone is touched by it, but in a little bit different way.
You know, when you just said those statistics, you said, from 10 to 14, and I started thinking mm-hmm. about a 10-year-old, that seems way
yeah.
too young to be even
yes.
contemplating. Why so young?
Yeah, well, and I have to tell you, I have talked to people who can actually remember, clients who can remember even back when they're younger having some of their first thoughts of suicide. And I think typically people in this age range who are thinking about suicide probably have experienced some very difficult things in their life. Up to that point in their life, they've just experienced very difficult things. I think also one of the things that happens in that 10 to 15-year-old age range is that that's where we're seeing mental health problems come out. And suicidal thinking tends to be associated with having a mental health disorder like depression or something, and that tends to start emerging in those teenage, young adult years when a person's body chemistry is changing. So that's some of the contribution there.
So is this more often something planned, or is it spontaneous?
Well, I think if I can say it's a little bit of both. There's a process that most people go through over time from starting to think about suicide, and as those thoughts get stronger and more difficult to resist, and usually it's associated with experiencing just a great deal of pain, just psychological pain from depression or other kind of mental health issues, as that gets worse and worse, that's a progression that takes place over time, and that can take a year for some people to get to that first time of thinking about suicide before they attempt suicide. But the actual decision to act on those thoughts tends to be less thought through, if I can put it that way, and a little bit more impulsive, like in the sense of, you know, you might be thinking across some time, hey, I just can't manage the pain I'm experiencing, but the actual decision might tend to be impulsive. Hey, I'm going to take an action now.
Of course, we've continued to hear reports about bullying and some of those things as being
right.
A growing factor. Social media doesn't let up, so it's not like it's just something an occasional thing, but it can sort of be ongoing.
That's right. And I should say there are people who experience things like bullying and difficult things in their life. So I don't want to suggest that. Sometimes people will say, well, of course they killed themselves because of the difficult thing they experienced. So, I mean, certainly we have examples of people who go through just horrendous, difficult things in life and don't kill themselves. So, but at the same time, there are very stressful life events in the lives of people who just experience that amount of pain that it just seems like escape through suicide seems like their best option.
We're going to talk more in the moments ahead about preventing suicide. We've talked a little bit about some of the realities of it. We want to address some of the myths surrounding suicide. Also talk a little bit about theology. That's so often that comes up. Is this a sin that's unforgivable? Is it a sin? Is it unforgivable? Talk about that and maybe some more theories about why it's attempted and how do we intervene? We do have some resources available. Karen's book, Preventing Suicide, it's a handbook for pastors, chaplains, and pastoral counselors, but I would say that it is full of very practical guidance that would be very useful for you, whether or not you are in the pastoral ministry. You'll find this a helpful resource, and we've got 3 copies to give away. We'll do that at the top of the hour in a drawing, and so if you'd like to enter for that, we'd be honored to have you give us a call at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. And it may be that you have a question, or maybe this is a personal experience in your family. You want to share a bit about your story, we'd be honored to have you call and join in with us. Talking to Karen Mason today, who is Associate Professor of Counseling and Psychology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. And working in the mental health area as a psychologist for a number of years, talking preventing suicide on Connecting Faith. There's more coming up. To Connecting Faith, we're looking at program planning in the new year. The conversation came up about suicide, and I thought this would be a good time to do it because I was under the illusion, as maybe others are, that after the holidays there's a spike in suicide attempts. We're going to find out that that is actually a myth and find out more with Karen Mason. Karen has written a book called Preventing Suicide. It's a handbook for pastors, chaplains, and pastoral counselors. She's also written When the Pieces Don't Fit, Making Sense of Life's Puzzles. She's Associate Professor of Counseling and Psychology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary and psychologist working in the mental health field. And Karen, it's not the holidays and the cold January days that lead the year in the suicide attempts, is it?
Well, it's interesting, Neil, because it is suicides, of course, can happen around the holidays and in those sort of dreary winter months. But the time when suicides spike actually in the year tends to be the spring. And nobody's quite sure exactly what it is, but some of the thoughts have to do with the fact that, in the spring, life is sort of coming back and people are coming out of their homes and is sort of enjoying the world around them. But if you're continuing to experience depression or something difficult, the juxtaposition of sort of spring with your own experience might be one of the reasons why spring tends to be the time when more suicides happen in the year.
That's one of the myths. There are other myths, too. Let's review some of those. For example, is this a cry for attention?
In some cases, I have to say there can be, some especially young people may not have skills for knowing exactly how to manage some of the suffering in their life, and they may actually maybe engage in some suicidal behavior, maybe non-suicidal behavior like cutting and that sort of thing. But I have to say, generally speaking, as a general rule, most people are experiencing such incredible pain and are just unable to find other ways out of that pain. There tends to be a way where suicidal people have difficulty coming up with other options. And so suicide is an option that comes to them, and they tend to, and people who kind of settle in on that being an option are the ones actually who are going to attempt or die by suicide.
I guess maybe it's another myth too. Think, well, it can't be stopped, as you talked about earlier. That those thoughts get stronger and it becomes more difficult to resist. Mm-hmm. Say more about that.
Yeah, and I just think that is one of the biggest myths that's important to challenge, because there is a way where I think big issues in this world, we have a tendency to, if we don't understand them, we have a tendency to just say, well, there's nothing we can do. And I think another example of that is, how do we prevent heart attacks? Back in the years of Eisenhower, when he had his heart attack, I know the scientific community wasn't sure whether there was anything you could do to prevent heart disease. And now, at this point in time, we have so much more understanding. I think the general public might have that same idea. Hey, it's not something we understand, and so we're not sure if we can prevent it. But in fact, one of the things that I think is so important as a Christian is just that there are so many things within our Christian faith that help us to prevent suicide. So just the hope that we have. You were on the station talking about Joni Erickson Tada's perspectives on suffering, how we manage suffering, the sense of community that we have in a church. All of these things are protective, and I think the more people can really understand that there are things that we can do, I think the more suicide does become preventable.
There is, of course, the myth that, sadly, that Christians may be affected with these thoughts should just pray harder. Say more about our misunderstandings that somehow Christians shouldn't be susceptible to this.
Yeah, and, it is interesting. There are people, I think, who believe that Christians are somehow immune from dealing with this particular issue. But the truth is, Christians do experience things like depression and other kind of mental health issues. And those, it's in those contexts usually that people start thinking about suicide. So I do think that however you think about how people get better from things like diabetes or other kinds of things like that could help us also think about the fact that when it comes to mental health issues, sometimes there just are some brain changes that really need to be dealt with for this person. And I should also just say, of course, as a Christian, this person does need to continue praying, right? This person needs to really get in touch with some of the things I was just mentioning earlier, like the sense of hope that God loves them, that God forgives people, that God gave you life. There's a sanctity of life there. But at the same time, that there are things sometimes that you have to do in order to reach out to get help for some of these issues that you're struggling with.
As medication, as you said, I mean, mental health issues often part of this. I mean, is there a sort of a direct link if you have, a chemical imbalance in the brain, some mental health issues, that mm-hmm. this is sort of the end of the continuum, that it's going to lead you this way eventually?
Well, not for all people. And one of the things that's interesting is that only maybe 1-3% of people with a mental health problem will actually think about suicide and die by suicide. So it's not that kind of a direct link, but most people who die by suicide have, you know, previous to their death, have been experiencing some kind of mental health issues. So it's interesting how the link goes one way, but not the other way. And so getting help for that mental health issue is part of the prevention that I think is so important.
Is, you know, we talked about Christians. You know, obviously, we need to take care of our brains, our bodies, like anyone else, but prayer as well, being connected with our body of believers. But
right.
Let's talk about the theology of this, because this seems to have always generated some conversation. Is this an unforgivable sin?
Yes, exactly. One thing I was so intrigued by when I was doing my research for the book is just that there is a wide spectrum of beliefs around this particular issue in the Christian community. There are some people, like even Martin Luther, the reformer, who believed that a person didn't have moral responsibility for the choice to die by suicide, which I find somewhat intriguing. There is also the belief in the Christian community that, suicide is a sin and, in fact, is forgivable. And there are others who believe it's a sin and it's unforgivable. So I do think it's so important to reflect theologically on this. And I think clergy, especially in interviews I've had, have said, boy, I wish I had thought about this before that suicidal person came to my office, or that parent who came to my office after son died by suicide. So definitely reflecting on your particular views, I think, are so important. But let me also just add to that I just think there's so much more theological complexity in terms of thinking through this issue of suicide. Like, you know, what if you believe that suicide is a sin but forgivable, are there other moral objections to suicide? And I would say yes. You know, the fact that God gave us life and there's a sanctity to that, I think, is an important piece. I just think the whole notion of hope, especially in the context of suffering as Christians, is just such an important theological concept. I think also life, you know, what are the reasons to continue to live when, in fact, maybe there are some difficult things you're going through? I think all of these are such important theological perspectives for people to reflect on.
We'll do more reflecting in the moments ahead on that, and also talk about intervention strategies. We want to get practical. There's a continuum of suicide, maybe from a low risk to high risk. Is there a way to respond in each circumstance there? We'll kind of summarize that a bit in the moments ahead. Invite you to join the conversation as well. You may have a question or a comment or a story or a reaction. You can call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. We do have several copies of Karen Mason's book, Preventing Suicide, to give away. We'll do a drawing for that at the top of the hour. You can sign up for that by giving us a call at 877-933-2484. Karen Mason's Associate Professor of Counseling and Psychology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, and a psychologist working in the mental health field for the past several decades, author of the book Preventing Suicide. And she's with us today on Connecting Faith. We'll take your calls at 877-933-2484. That contemplate suicide just have some challenges just understanding who they are, how God made them, and having confidence in His plans and purposes. We don't begin to fully understand those thoughts, but as those thoughts get stronger, it's difficult to resist. And we're talking today about preventing suicide. Are there some things that we can do? Karen Mason has been a psychologist working in the mental health field for several decades. She's Associate Professor of Counseling and Psychology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, and has authored several books, including When the Pieces Don't Fit, Making Sense of Life's Puzzles, and her new one is called Preventing Suicide. And this is a handbook for specifically for pastors, chaplains, and pastoral counselors, but there's great resources available here and good insights if this is an area you want to read up more on and find some help and encouragement. And we'll give you some information as well, some resources, websites, and phone numbers where you can go for help too. But Karen, let's talk a little bit about intervention strategies. And I know that you address a sort of a continuum from a low risk to a high risk. I mean, how do we evaluate, I guess, where someone is on that continuum? What are the best prevention strategies?
I do think that getting some skills to try to figure out where a person is on that continuum is helpful. I'm thinking, though, of the Philippian jailer where the earthquake happens while Paul and his companion is in jail, and Paul, yells out to the jailer, "Don't kill yourself." And I just think that's such a great example of a suicide intervention and prevention, where Paul prevents a suicide actually from happening by just speaking out. And I do think that that is one of the first steps, and primarily because it is really hard to know where somebody might be on that continuum in terms of are those thoughts strong or not strong at this point in time. And one way I like to think about that is to think about if I was planning to go on a trip to France, if I just sort of dream about it, that might be sort of the first step on the continuum. But if I actually make a plan and get out my calendar and say, hey, this is going to happen on thus and such a date, then I'm much farther along on the continuum to actually getting on a plane to France. And then if I actually buy those tickets, I'm really far along. And if you think about the suicide continuum in a little bit the same way, usually those thoughts initially are a little bit more vague in terms of, would I even follow up on them? How would I do that? Having the courage, as Paul had, to speak up to this person and ask them, where are you on that continuum? Not that Paul did that, but he intervened because he had a sense for the seriousness of the situation, I think is important. And most people I've talked to in interviews have talked about going to get training in order to really understand how to make that assessment. So there is information in my book, but at the same time, I would really encourage people to look up training. There's some great training on livingworks.net is a good website that offers training to people around trying to figure out where on that suicide continuum a person is, or QPR.org. So there are a number of different really great training resources for people, and I'd hate to give people the feeling that a short sort of exposure to this would give you the full picture on how to really understand where they are on the continuum.
But to speak up, though, and as you've suggested, right, ask people where they are, how serious they are. But that's a legitimate thing to ask, right? Are you serious about this?
Absolutely. And I think some people, this is one of the myths. Some people believe that plants the idea in their mind. But generally, if you think about, if you try to put yourself in the shoes of a person who's thinking about suicide, they didn't plan on having these thoughts. They might be puzzled by them or confused by them and really not know how to reach out to somebody else and say, hey, I'm having these thoughts of suicide. So you actually asking the person is sometimes a relief to them to say, for them to realize, hey, there's this person who's willing to talk to me about this issue.
How do we talk to those that maybe have attempted? Is there anything in particular that we should be sensitive to and aware of?
One of the things, and I think this goes back to the idea of some of the myths around suicide that I think we were talking a little bit earlier about, well, suicide's just trying to get attention, and the best thing to do is to ignore it, which is sort of what you do when a child's having a tantrum, but I don't think it's the wisest thing to do after a person has attempted suicide. I think it is really important to take it seriously. The risk for another suicide attempt actually is pretty high for several days to a year to 5 years following a suicide attempt. So taking it seriously, I think, is really important. And I guess the what I would suggest if you're worried about a person and you're feeling like I'm not really sure what to do here, I would call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-TALK, and problem solve with them, you know, what might be helpful for this person who maybe is sitting with you. That might be a resource that would be helpful in that situation.
All right, if we don't get anything else today, get that number down, the Suicide Prevention Hotline, 800-273-TALK, right?
Yes,
all right.
Exactly.
All right, find that a place to go for help. You know, you spend some time in your work and also in the book, Preventing Suicide, talking about the church and the community and the surviving mm-hmm. family members. So mm-hmm. let's speak to those. How can we best counsel and support and come around those that surviving family members in the greater church community?
Yes. Well, you know, one of the things that's so difficult is that the grief following a suicide really is more complicated than the grief following other kinds of death, because, I mean, this is really something very shocking, very difficult news, very unexpected. It can be very traumatic just thinking about the incredible pain this family member was in before they took their life and how it happened. And so I think one of the things to really understand if you're in a church situation is that these people really do need you to come around them. And what happens, I think, sometimes is that because there's a stigma around suicide, we're afraid to come around people who are really suffering this kind of grief. And sometimes family members following a suicide aren't getting the same kind of help, like bringing casserole dishes to their home or being willing to you know, just sit with them. And your quote from now on earlier was just such a poignant quote, because it's just all about how, you know, the importance of a ministry of presence, of just being able to sit with people following such a difficult, difficult thing like suicide.
There's a, I think we often don't know what to say.
Yeah.
Thinking, you know, if there's one that occurs, is there a possibility that there's dangers of, I know we've heard about, you know, suicide clusters. So, I mean, that could happen maybe in a school setting or aware of, or maybe it's a, you know, a Native American reservation or something. You mm-hmm. hear about multiple ones kind of happening in short order.
Yes, exactly. So one of the things to be concerned about in terms of a cluster is that clusters won't happen unless there's some kind of contagion. And think about contagion as catching the cold from your coworker. You know, you don't catch the cold from your coworker unless you have some kind of vulnerability to it, like your immune system is compromised in some way. The same thing. So if a suicide happens in a church community, or as you were saying, a Native American reservation or a school, usually there are certain people that tend to be more vulnerable to it. And the important thing is just to seek those people out and monitor them the same way you would monitor somebody who's struggling with suicide. Just keep a close relationship with them. And this might be people who were part of their close friend group. It might be somebody who has attempted suicide themselves. So finding those vulnerable people and keeping a close relationship with them, I just think is so important to prevent those clusters.
Now, one of our callers wanted to know if you've studied sort of veterans and PTSD. Are those, we, you know, have heard more about that maybe recently. Are those rates higher than average or normal?
Well, you know, I think there's a little bit of debate about that. There's certainly on the news you will often hear that it's a higher rate, and then others will say that with because I was mentioning because suicide tends to be the so high in the 15 to 34 year old age range, and excuse me, this tends to be the age of veterans. So I think there's still some debate about that. But there's definitely just, I haven't myself done that research, but there's just a lot of great research out there on looking at the connection between military trauma and PTSD, and then later depression, and then the suicidal thinking, and then suicide. Certainly, it's a population, a group of people that we're just so concerned for because, I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
because they gave of themselves for our country. So, of course, it's regardless of how, you know, whether the rates are higher or not, I think it's a tragic thing.
You mentioned the suicide prevention hotline number, 800-273-TALK. Other resources that we could look toward to find out more, maybe as kind of a clearinghouse or a center?
Yes, yes. So I think the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, and that's SPRC.org. So suicidepreventionresourcecenter.org. Is a great clearinghouse that can send you to the many, many, many other resources around this particular issue of suicide. So there are many, many other great websites, but I just think SPRC.org is a great clearinghouse. There are resources for clergy, for schools, for just regular people like us. I just think it's just a great resource.
Karen, if there's one word you could say to clergy today, pastors, chaplains, counselors, what would it be about this issue?
That it's preventable. You know, if we can get our heads around the fact that it's preventable, then we will, in fact, muster our resources and do something about this, you know, this 10th leading cause of death in the United States. And I think the church just has so much to offer.
We're going to talk more about some things that are preventable coming up in moments ahead after the break. Lisa Marone will join us for our regular Monday visit. But I want to thank Karen Mason for coming on today on the broadcast, referencing her book, Preventing Suicide. Karen's Associate Professor of Counseling and Psychology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, author of the book, When the Pieces Don't Fit, Making Sense of Life Puzzled, and Preventing Suicides, a handbook for pastors, chaplains, and counselors. We do have some copies of that to give away, and we'll do that at the top of the hour at 877-93-FAITH. You can sign up for that, 877-93-FAITH. Karen, thank you for the work you're doing here, and God bless you as you continue to provide hope and encouragement in this area.
Thank you so much, Neil.
You're listening to Connecting Faith.
Radio.
It's 48 past the hour, and time for our regular Monday health visit with Lisa Marone. Lisa is a physical therapist, professor, an author and speaker, encouraging people to get healthy for heaven's sake, title of one of our great books. And we've had a chance to talk with Lisa over the months together. Glad to have her back with us. Lisa, thanks for joining back with us. I know you were in our area here in Des Moines here a couple of weeks ago, or was it last weekend? I think it was.
Actually, it was just last weekend, Neil. I had a great time, and I was so excited that you guys warmed up the Midwest for me. It was close to 50 degrees, which was almost 50 degrees warmer than it was when I was there last January. So, yay.
All right. We're trying to, you know, we're doing our part for global warming here or something, maybe. I'm not sure. Well, today.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was speaking at the Inspire Health Conference in Des Moines, Iowa, and we just had a wonderful time there. And hundreds of people were out, and they were looking to get healthy for heaven's sake, and they came out and got some real life-changing messages and inspiration that weekend.
Good. Well, today, I want to talk about a health issue that maybe many of us don't know enough about, so we want to review the 5 warning signs of a stroke. Maybe we need to start with definition. What are we talking about when we say stroke?
Yeah, you know, we've probably all heard of a stroke, but really what it would be more aptly named as would be a brain attack. We all know what a heart attack is, but a stroke is really a brain attack. It's a crisis within the brain that has to do with the blood supply. We're either getting too much blood to an area where we have a vessel that starts to bleed and leak, and that's called a brain aneurysm or a hemorrhagic stroke, or we have more commonly an ischemic stroke where one of our little vessels in our brain becomes clogged, and then that area of the brain that blood would have fed is becoming, it has a lack of oxygen and, of course, a lack of nutrition because the blood flow, its food, has been stopped. So that's really what we're talking about when we're talking about strokes.
You mentioned the ischemic being common. So how common are events like these, and is anyone susceptible?
You know, when we have cardiovascular disease, we're absolutely more susceptible to stroke. But the other thing that makes us more susceptible is if we have insulin resistance. Neil, we've talked about that on a number of different shows because it just has tentacles that reach into every aspect of our lives. And when we have insulin resistance, which happens when we eat too many sugars and refined flours and we become our blood sugars become a little high, our body gets in a state of inflammation. And inflammation in the blood vessels is a bad thing because the lining of our blood vessels in an inflamed state are more prone to plaquing. And so that's where we end up with these ischemic strokes. So it's really important, going all the way back to our heart health, that we keep our diets and our bodies healthy in terms of our body weight.
And these, of course, can obviously be deadly, right? I mean, there are different levels of stroke outcome, but just talk a bit more about that.
Yeah. You know, I was talking with my patient this week. She was an older woman, 70 years old, and she was describing to me these two little mini incidents that she had had, and she said, I think they were called TIAs, and I said, oh, yes, a transient ischemic attack. I said, what you had were mini strokes, and she looked at me horrified, and she said, well, they didn't tell me that in the hospital, that they were strokes. They just said they were these transient things. And what a mini stroke is, or this transient ischemic attack, is when a blood vessel becomes blocked, but it's a temporary block. It's often resolved within a couple of hours up to a full day. And what would happen with this, my patient, is that she would become confused and lose her memory. One day her husband came home and she had baked all these muffins and he said, okay, you were ready for the meeting? And she said, what meeting? And he said, well, isn't that why you baked all these muffins? And she said, what muffins? And she was just completely out of touch with her day. And so that's a mini stroke. But one-third of people who have mini strokes will go on to have full-blown strokes at some point in their lives. So they're very serious.
Which, I guess, brings up the importance of the kind of speed of response that truly can be the difference between life and death. What things should we know about and how do we respond?
Yeah, well, we really need to know what the warning signs of a stroke is because the quicker we respond, the better it is for life and for recovery. And so one of the first things you want to do if you think that yourself or someone that you're with might be having a stroke is there are going to be changes in their face or their arm and leg. And typically numbness will occur, can occur in the face. It might run down the arm. It might be in the leg. But in the face, we're also going to see a drooping of an eye or maybe the corner of a mouth just on one side, not on both sides, because a stroke happens on one side of the brain. So these are typically one-sided issues. Another thing which comes on with these hemorrhagic strokes or brain aneurysms is a severe headache with a really rapid onset. You know, I mean, within minutes, you're going from a 0 to a 10 out of 10 headache. This might have some mental confusion with it, with any kind of stroke, or even some difficulty understanding speech. So that's the things to look out for. Other things that are really important is looking at if you're having trouble seeing, maybe one or even maybe both of your eyes, but are you getting blurry vision that's just come on all of a sudden? Are you having difficulty speaking or getting the right words out? When I was pregnant, Neil, with my first child, actually it was with my second child, I was reading a book to my first child, and my vision became a little blurry, and I said, oh, no, I must have to go get my wascals. And I heard myself say that very strange word when I meant to say glasses. And so I was having a pregnancy-induced transient ischemic attack, which faded in just a few seconds. But these are things to be concerned about. And the last warning sign would be balance. If someone's, you know, suddenly out of balance, having trouble walking, those are real important warning signs. We need to act quickly on those.
And in terms of, you know, if we're with someone that's exhibiting some of those characteristics, some signs, is it a matter just, you know, 911, or are there things that we can do, you know, while we're waiting for medical help?
Yeah. You know, that is going to be depend upon one thing in particular. If someone is having these type of symptoms and signs and there is no headache associated with them, medical knowledge would say to give them a small baby aspirin if you have it on hand. Because what aspirin does is it thins the blood. So if you're having an ischemic attack where there is some kind of clot or narrowing in the vessel, the baby aspirin would thin the blood and get more blood to the area so that part of that brain does not die. Now, that would be very deadly to do if someone has a severe headache, because if they have a severe headache associated with this, now we have one of those bleeding type of strokes, those aneurysms. And the last thing we want to do is thin the blood out and make the bleeding more excessive. So absolutely 911 or jump in the car, get that person to the emergency room. The quicker they can get them treated and assessed, the better their outcome is.
Well, before we go, are we making progress in terms of prevention and treatment? Are there some hopeful signs there?
Well, you know, I would hope that with all of this information getting out there that we were having better outcomes. I know we do have better outcomes, but in terms of the frequency of stroke, unfortunately, Neil, no, the numbers are not going down. With all the information we have, we're still not applying it to ourselves, and maybe we're just thinking, well, that won't happen to me. And so I'm just here to say, listen, anything can happen to you, and so wouldn't it be great, for the kingdom's sake, if we did everything that we could to stay well and veer away from these potentially deadly or disabling diseases?
Always wise advice, and we want to do all that we can, be good stewards of the bodies that God's entrusted us to. And it gets back to, I guess, Lisa, just watching what we eat, it has some side effects way beyond just our, you know, a few pounds around the middle.
Yeah, Neil, everything that you can think of, every disease, cancer, disability, and early death has to do with, comes down to three things. How much are you sleeping? What types of food are you eating? And are you moving on purpose and getting enough exercise? Everything comes down to those three things. I wish there was a different answer, but there's not.
Yeah, but we still love you anyway, and we're going to have you back. So, but yeah, if you can work on a different answer before our next Monday visit, that'd be great. So.
Yeah, if the answer was like, eat more jelly donuts, I would be on every day.
Okay, that's true. Well, Lisa, we love having you on and giving us wise counsel and encouragement. Lisa Marone's physical therapist, professor, and author, speaker, and encouraging us to get healthy for heaven's sake, and some good wise words today about strokes. Looking forward to our chat a week from Mondays. Thanks again.
Absolutely. Have a super day.
Lisa Marone joining us today on Connecting Faith. Well, tomorrow we're going to connect and talk about the stoppage of immigrants coming in from certain countries. That's created a firestorm of protest. What's happening in the world of refugee resettlement? World Relief has been in the middle of it for decades. They're a wonderful organization and outreach. Matthew Sorens will join us to talk about our choices and how we respond to the refugees. Is it one of fear or one of compassion? Join us for that conversation tomorrow on Connecting Faith. If you missed today's show, you can find it posted online at myfaithradio.com. Click on the Connecting Faith show page.